session number 30304.
Terrain at Reel 35.
I flew down to Northolt Aerodrome, whence I was taken by staff car to HQ, with instructions to report to Group Captain Nolan, the senior personnel officer. After a brief and pleasant introductory chat, which always makes you suspicious, he informed me that he had scrutinized my records and was offering me the post of personal assistant to Air Marshal Baker. This was music to my ears, for the needs of the service beyond the end of the war were emerging as a possible choice for between leaving the RAF or staying on, and such a posting would enhance one's prospects. The Air Marshal, I was told, needed an articulate, presentable officer who would pay attention to detail and who could fly his personal Hudson aircraft anywhere, anytime, and I was one of the most experienced Hudson pilots left. Oh, well, he eulogized my service record with no mention of my gas and then went on to say it was a never-ending job and probably with no home leave, as it was an overseas posting. And the job would mean that the posting would go with it until the end of the war. The Air Marshal had been given command of the RAF's recently formed Balkan Air Force. Do you have any problems that can't be put aside for, say, a couple of years? It's a job which won't allow worries at the back of one's mind. Well, unfortunately, I had, domestically, and though I was sorely tempted to dismiss them and the responsibility involved, the domestic matters, bearing in mind that my mother was a widow and getting rather aged, had no other children, which would need resolving in considerably less than 2 years, and I gave him the details. However, I do count my blessings, sir. I've been more fortunate than many, in fact, than most of my friends, and needs must. And then I remembered the end of that particular adage, continued hurriedly. I beg pardon, sir. If it's necessary. Don't concern yourself, he replied. This isn't a posting by command. Obviously, relishing the play on words. We're just offering an opportunity to an appropriate officer, and I don't doubt someone will jump at the chance. You obviously can't. Well, I thanked him, then made a pensive car journey back to Northolt, and thence back to Lucas, by which time I was convinced I'd done myself a bit of no good. Well, after another 3 weeks of the usual Babs routine with 1510 flight, it was therefore all the more surprising to be ordered once more to present myself for interview at HQCC. Again, I reported to Group Captain Nolan. He seemed a little more brusque this time. There's more of a command element about this one, were his first meaningful words after the usual introductory preamble. Evidently pleased to continue the use of the pun. You are to take a staff appointment here at headquarters in the post of Air 2, which at present is held by the American golfer Charles Sweeney, one of the originals of the Eagle Squadron. Your immediate boss will be Squadron Leader Powell, known as Air 1. Squadron Leader Powell was, in fact, a well-known pilot with decorations, having many hours and sinkings from Catalina flying boats, which were not to everyone's taste. Anyway, he was Air 1. Can you report for duty on Monday next? I certainly could. My faith in Anglo-American cooperation, received a boost when it was rumoured that Flight Lieutenant Sweeney had a role elsewhere in helping the final playoff achieve par for the course. For a staff appointment at this stage, even after being obliged to turn down a plum job, would look just as good on my file as a PA posting. It would also give me an insight into the workings of a command headquarters. So I took the Anson back to Lucas at maximum cruising speed, seldom used before, and hurried through the routine of permanent departure. If I had believed an option on the posting existed without detrimental consequences, perhaps I would have sought to avoid it, for I've been very happy with Tubby Summox and his cheerful outfit. During a final drink, he said I may be moving on at the right time. Whether he had an inkling that the unit might be leaving so that Lucas could revert to strike duties, I knew not. But within weeks, 1510 had transferred to Blackpool.
What were your duties at headquarters?
Sorry?
What were your duties at headquarters?
As Air 2, we were... It was a desk job. We had, between us, Air 1 and Air 2, we shared an office, and we had some responsibilities for the administration of the Coastal Command communications flight, and the efficient administration of the ops room. Both of which, of course, were welcome escapes from the desk-bound part of the job. Reasonably frequently we had to... I had to do most of the communications flying. Not that we did very much, but I mean that in the sense that George Powell was more important that he should be in the office than that I should be in the office. So I was thankful for the fact that he was in charge because I got out more. And also, I wanted to stretch my legs. Of course, I could go down in the ops room, and it was wonderful to see what was happening there, because by that time, most commands were receiving information about virtually everything that was happening. If it was to take a member of the coastal staff out to some station, I remember going to Hawkins on one occasion, which had been bombed during 1940, but had now become a sort of connecting unit with the continent. That kind of thing. In various aircraft, there were Percival Proctors, a Domini, which quite enjoyed flying, a typical de Havilland machine, almost like the Tiger Moth in its flight characteristics. Of course, it was a biplane. And one or two other smarter aircraft. So it wasn't too bad a job. But as the war in Europe came to an end, and an emphasis was being put on improving supplies to the Far East, one of the tedious jobs I had to do was to facilitate the paperwork which was necessary to get flying boat squadrons out to the Far East. We called them REFORS, REFORS, papers. And it seemed to me that there's an awful lot of paperwork. It would have been much simpler to have told a crew to take a flying boat and just off, as it were. But, you know, I was 24 at the time. I was just really enjoying the war. And
can you describe the operations room to me?
The operations room, yes. It was quite a sight, because as one might see from shots, that appear in films, it was a matter of a large operations board, covering the whole of one wall. And this was in an underground room, of course, an area reminiscent of a bridge of a ship, opposite to it, from which the controller and the senior officers conducted the operations of the day and of course, night. And the board was, in effect, a large outline map of the whole Atlantic area, from the eastern seaboard of North America across to Europe, including the Mediterranean, and almost as far as the Middle East. There were symbols representing various forces, and they were moved to appropriate positions by members of the WAF, climbing up step ladders to add or move a symbol, and then coming down again to await the next order. And in the midst of all this, the most interesting period of the war, there was an air of hushed efficiency as the symbols covered a panorama of activity by all our forces. This was history, total but transient. In the Atlantic, the position and strength of convoys, escorts, U-boats, aircraft, engagements with the enemy. In the western end of the English Channel, the patrols in support of the invasion forces, with a similar responsibility at the eastern end. The missions of photo reconnaissance and air sea rescue aircraft. The changing pattern of the battles raging in northern France. The US Army dash into Brittany. Bomber Command support as the Canadians struggle towards the Falaise Gap. And the surrender of the Germans defending the citadel at Saint-Malo. The continued maritime transport of reinforcements across the Channel and the developing attack against oil targets pursued by Bomber Command and the US AAF 8th Air Force. This was the expanding human conflict reduced to symbolic representation on a large black square. So you can imagine that the poor old WAFs were pretty busy. And if one is supposedly kept fit by going up and down ladders, these girls must have been very, very fit. Yes, we had Mew girls for use by the staff. I remember taking one senior officer who preferred to be chauffeured on some mission, or delivering documents to various bases provided an opportunity to handle a joystick instead of a pen. A fleeting attraction of a different kind I could see as I cycled from my billet in Northwood up the hill to HQ at Eastbury Park on the 17th, that's another 17th, of September. It was part of the Air Armada, off tug aircraft and gliders, on its way to Nijmegen. On the way to Nijmegen and the ill-fated dropping zones of Arnhem, with the sound of hundreds of straining engines filling the bright morning sky. The new symbol appearing on the ops board was one of many changes which have moved southwards and eastwards since I first saw it on taking up my appointment. Not only had the battle for the bridges across the lower Rhine and the rivers Maas and Waal now been joined, but resistance to the enemy garrison in Brest had ended, and Boulogne was ready to fall to the Canadians after heavy bombing. And the sight of a German flying bomb overhead a couple of nights later enlivened conversation in Northwood. I was walking down the road to my billet when the throbbing drone of a V1 broke the silence of a deserted street. A jet of orange flame suddenly came into view at a height of about, I would say, 300 feet. Flying bombs seldom penetrated to the northwest suburbs of London. Certainly, this one had overshot its target. Open countryside lay beyond. Unless, across the channel, the dispatching crew had by some miracle targeted HQCC. How ridiculous. On immediate second thoughts, this was impossible, as the V1 was a random terror weapon lacking precision. It was an acknowledgement. This, to me, was an acknowledgement that air superiority in manned aircraft had irrevocably passed to the Allies. The target the V1 reached depended entirely on the point at which the jet had used up all its fuel. And the engine stopped, the bomb fell to earth and exploded. And the interval between engine failure and explosion was usually about 10 long seconds.
With the headquarters at Norfolk, was it all underground?
Oh, no. No, our office was, in fact, on the second floor, I think. So we had to go down quite a bit and go down there. No, I would say that, I don't know. I mean, I didn't explore it as a honeycomb. I was probably the most junior rank there. I don't remember seeing any flying officers, and they were all senior. I've since regretted, of course, as one does with hindsight, but when the time came, I foolishly decided I wanted to get back to flying. I'd had enough by the spring of 1945, to the early spring, being desk-bound, with just a bit of flying now and again. I'm sure they had enough flying boats out in the Far East by now and could do without me. George wanted, he was due to take a squadron as a wing commander, and he just wanted to go. So I knew that I would be facing a new boss if I didn't try and get out about the same time. So I applied again to go to shipping attack squadron, but without any generosity on anybody's part. And instead, they said, well, the only thing we can offer, as you've done quite a bit of instructing, you can go and take an RAF qualified flying instructor's course at Upavon. Before I finally decided that I would do that, George mentioned to me that he had, let me put it another way, it was a strong possibility that I would take his job as a squadron leader. But flying was too much in my blood to want to sit there in the same room, his desk over there, my desk here. So I've regretted it in some ways since, but I did enjoy what I did most of the time in Flying Training Command. For one thing, training station was at Upavon, which was a very pleasant pre-First World War, it was developed during the First World War airfield, with almost, you might say, roses round the door. I enjoyed the flying that I did there. And then, after passing out as a qualified flying instructor, being posted to Little Rissington, which I thought was a very good example of going full circle. I got my wings from there, and I was actually demobbed from there as well.
What was the training that you had to do as an instructor? How did that vary from the instructing work that you'd done before?
Well, whereas the OTU instructing, and this applies to any OT operational training unit, you are specifically instructing pilots into operational matters. You're teaching them to take an aircraft off and to bring it back and land for, obviously, for some operation or other, so that you've got to restrict the... perhaps not restrict isn't a very good word, but to at least confine your instruction, not stray outside necessary boundaries into more theoretical applications, such as you might meet in ordinary, I don't mean ordinary in the ordinary sense, but the usual type of instruction for being able to pass on your knowledge, whatever type of aircraft it might be. In other words, to fully qualify as an RAF qualified instructor, you could be put into a different aircraft, the one being used to flying, and just simply be given the manual expect to know a great deal about it within a couple of hours, including a takeoff and landing. Which I wouldn't attempt to do unless I'd had that kind of training to allow me to do it. The basic laws, if you like, of flying are doubly important for the needs of fully fledged instructing over most kinds of aircraft. I say most because new aircraft coming on stream for the first time, of course, are handled in a different way in that instructing respect. To have this extra knowledge that one gets from a specially designed course so that you can apply that knowledge generally throughout a different range of aircraft, there is the difference. When I'm flying a Hudson, when I'm instructing on a Hudson, the thought uppermost in my mind is this pilot, new to it, has got to be trained so that he can take this aircraft to a target, attack the target, bring it back, and land it safely in most kinds of weather. And I think that signifies the difference between getting into an aircraft to do that and getting into an aircraft that you haven't flown before. You do know the principles of flight and in the greatest detail. You do know more about such things as hydraulics, navigation, the forces acting on an aircraft, the forces acting on the body, and so on, which is what you might call a general course in instructing rather than a specific one.
So how were you instructed to become an instructor? How did he do that?
Well, at that time, it seemed to me that perhaps this is being unfair, and perhaps I and other ex-operational people who had come across several different types of flying. I mean, flying in bad weather conditions or difficult terrain. There seemed to be on the staff at the flying instructor school, the central flying school was split into, I don't know how many, but I went to number 7 flying instructor school, and there was one in southern Rhodesia, I think, one in Canada, I don't know. But Central Flying School sort of became a number of Central Flying Schools. And I don't think that what my colleagues, those on the course, and I went through, it would be a fair reflection of what the RAF was capable of and has been since. Without the absolute excellence that is taken for granted these days. And wartime conditions had a lot to do with that. So that we had some instructors who had not been on operations. That in itself, I think, was mistaken policy or unavoidable policy, I don't know. I didn't really see many of the people who were instructing me as co-pilots if I were going on a trip with them. I hope I'm not being unkind, but they didn't have, somehow, they didn't have the knack of communication that I'd come to expect. And amongst the chaps I knew who'd simply come from squadrons, perhaps because, I mean, you didn't always go from a squadron to an OTU for what was vaguely known as your rest period. You could go to other things like drogue towing and other forms of instruction. Even on the OTUs, there were two sections. There was one section which was specific, the one in which I was a member of both, one and